All right, Pete, this is your, what, your 10th time running this race? You finished fifth three times previously. Those are your best finishes, so this is, you've been a competitive racer pretty much from the get-go in this race, but this year in particular, at what point were you thinking this was different than the previous nine races that you've done here?
Honestly, I felt like this team was pretty special, probably the best team I've ever had, but you know, even with that confidence, wasn't really sure how the race would play out until I was in it, and then halfway through the race, things just seemed like they were clicking, and being able to push to Kel-Tag to take my eight, I felt like the team didn't need that eight up until then, and I think that really helped us on the coast, being able to take that lead.
A lot of people watching the tracker and following the race closely thought that the run from Grayling to Eagle Island is where you asserted yourself, because most of your competition had already taken their eight, you had not, and you blew away their run times. Is there something there that you noticed, a spark that the team had going up the river there?
I don't know if it was a spark. We just got some trail that the team really likes, and we didn't see much of that this race. So my team really likes hard, fast trails where they can go fast, and that was probably the best trail for that type of running the whole race. So when they got on that, they really wanted to roar, and actually held them back for most of that run. So and then we ran out of that kind of trail for the rest of the race. So, but they really did want to go fast. We'd hit brief sections of good fast trail, and they'd go like heck. And then, but most of it was this soft deep drifted trail for at least the last 300-400 miles, feels like.
So a lot of people want to know. I mean, you talked about it on the insider video in Elim. Elim's always that checkpoint where a lot of people think it's a race to White Mountain, so Elim's the last chance to sort of do something in the checkpoint where you can either fool your competition or make a move. And everyone remembers in 2008 when Jeff King fell asleep and Lance Mackey hung his snowsuit on the hook and left and snuck out. But you said on the video you didn't want to do anything sneaky, you know, yours, your buddy. Describe a little bit what was going on in the checkpoint there when he pulled in, where you guys were talking about things.
Yeah, I was kind of unsure of what to do there. I knew I wanted to take a break. It just was a matter of how long of a break I could take, but not allow, because he was, I don't know, 50 minutes behind or something. So I needed a break, but I didn't want to allow him to take a big break either. So I kind of settled on 2 to 2.5 hours. And there was some awkward silence as we were eating in the checkpoint, and he said he wanted to go take a nap, and he asked how long I was staying, and it was about time for me to leave anyway. So instead of him going and falling asleep and then me running out the door, I just asked him how long are you planning on staying, or are you going to follow me out of here, because I figured he was going to follow me out. He was just going to wait until I left, and then he was going to follow me out. And he said, well, I'm going to follow you out. So I said, well, okay, you better not take a nap because I'm leaving. So then we went out and got ready, and he followed me out of there. So
okay. And then lastly, obviously the 77 mile run in here, you know that you have a world class last year's champ chasing you in. Did you see his headlamp? Did you have any idea how far back he was? What was that like?
Nerve-wracking, really. Even a 40 or 50 minute lead, whatever it was, it's a long run here, especially on that type of a trail. I mean, I don't know what it took, 11 hours or something. And so anything can happen. And I really didn't feel confident until we hit the road over here. I mean, I was looking back quite often, and knowing the type of driver he is and the type of team he has, that I didn't count him out. And I knew we were going slow enough that he could make up time quickly if he got his team rolling. So, I didn't feel like I had it won at any point until coming down the road here.
Okay. That's all I got, so we'll go around right here.
You and Nick were running pretty close throughout most of the race. What was it like for you passing him on the way up to Koyuk? And did you guys exchange words at all or hardly see each other?
It was brief. I said hi, and he said hi, and that was it.
Did you know what was happening? Did you have a sense of that he was having some trouble, or what did you feel?
I did. I had an idea when I got there that there was something going on. So, it was just, I don't know. I just was focused on keep moving into the wind across the sea ice there.
Pete, when did you feel like this was your race to lose, or did you ever?
No, I mean, that's, you know, unless you have a 20-hour lead or something with 100 miles to go, then, and even that could be stopped by a crazy storm out here. So I felt like we had a shot, and I wanted to keep working at putting ourselves in as good a position as we could to take advantage of a misstep by somebody in front of us or weather or anything. So we just kept plugging along and trying to make sure we were in position to have a shot at it. And so that's what we did, and it worked out.
Did you say anything? Did you pass through the cabin where Nick was, and did that kind of set in that, all right, well, I'm in the lead at this point?
He was stopped before the cabin when I passed him, so he was still out on the ice. Yeah, but I mean, at that point, I knew I was in the lead, but yeah, I mean, it didn't mean a whole lot to me besides, you know, yours right behind me and Jesse's right behind us, and I figured maybe Nick was going to leave, so even though I'm in the lead, there's a bunch of really good teams together, so it's still anybody's race at that point.
How did it feel watching your wife and your family as you came into that shoot? I even heard some people Facebook Live, and they weren't you, and they were saying, this is the best day of my life. How does that feel looking at them coming in?
It's awesome. I mean, this is, like I've said it before, it's not just about me. You know, there's 42 dogs in our kennel, and our support system is incredible, and the whole community and region and everybody out there. And I mean, you saw it tonight. Half the town jumped on jets to come up here and watch me finish, and it's incredible. I mean, I'm so humbled by that and appreciative, and it's so motivating. It's very special.
Were there tears in the embrace? As she said, there were for her.
Yeah, there was.
Can you talk about your rest schedule and how you seemed like you, especially in the last third of the race, were taking longer breaks than most of the other front pack? And I'm just curious if you were sticking to your own plan or making it up on the fly.
Yeah, I mean, I generally have kind of an idea of what I'm going to do, but it's never set in stone. It's just more on the fly, you know. I mean, a lot of these runs, a run can take 5 hours on a good trail, 8 hours on a bad trail, just like this race played out. I mean, all these runs turned out to be 2 or 3 hours longer than they could have been on a good trail. So you got to be able to adjust your rest accordingly, I feel like. And if you just have something put on pen to paper of what you're going to do no matter what, I don't think it's going to work out that great. So, yeah. And there's other things that factor into deciding how long to rest, where and when, and all that stuff too.
Pete, can you talk a little bit about how you built your kennel to get to this point?
Well, we started out with some dogs that my dad got, and then when I got more serious about it, I bought some dogs from Jeff King and two females in particular, and they're pretty much the moms to the entire kennel, so we've pretty much based off of that. And every dog in the team here was born and raised in our yard, and I think just about every dog but one in our kennel was raised in our yard now. So we've worked hard since 2010 at developing our own dog and our own bloodline, and you know, finding what works for us. And pretty fulfilling to have it all work out like this.
Pete, talk about how the difference in your kennel in rural Alaska, developing a kennel that's competitive on this stage in Bethel compared to, you know, the challenges you have. It's a total different deal. Talk about that.
Yeah, the training and the logistics is challenging, and the cost, of course, being in rural Alaska. But I think, you know, part of that is offset by the support that I have out there, and that's something that you don't find everywhere. So I'm fortunate to have that, and it means a lot.
What? Sorry. I heard someone in the shoot yell out Yupik Pride. Is this going to be a big moment for the Yupik people to see you win?
I hope so, and not just Yupik people, but all of the, you know, rural native people from Western Alaska or anywhere in the state for that matter. It really doesn't matter. Anybody who could get a kick out of this that's awesome, you know.
What do you think? What do you think this does for the profile of mushing in the Delta and for the enthusiasm in the Delta and now having a champion, the first really from the region?
I mean, I don't know exactly, you know, something I'd have to think about, but obviously it shows that somebody from out there can, you know, have a dream and put it all together and work hard and things can happen like this. So it's not impossible. So I think that's probably the biggest thing that can be learned or taken from this.
Anybody else?
what do you want to do with your platform? You'll now have an audience. You'll have the ability to speak to a lot of people. What do you want to say to them?
I don't know right now, actually. Brain's a little foggy, but yeah, I don't know.
We saw some video today following the Cusco 300 with you and your leg wrestling. You came out a champion in that one. And a little foreshadowing, or is it special that you shared this moment with him and racing to the finish?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yours really taken a beating now the last month. But no, that was all fun and games. Me and you are really good buddies, and it's a pleasure to race against him and travel with him. You know, he's a very humble champion and has been a great champion over the last year for this race. And it's a weird dynamic when you're friends with somebody but you're also fierce competitors, you know. I mean, I would have been totally bummed out if he would have passed me coming in here. At the same time, you know, that's what we're here to do. We're not drawing straws to see who comes in first, so we're out there to race each other.
What did he say to you in the chute?
No, I don't remember. Said he didn't want to leg wrestle anymore.
Pete, can you talk about, you said that this kind of shows that someone who's out there can have a dream and put it all together and work hard. How long has this been a dream?
I mean, I've been thinking about this since I was a little kid, really. I mean, it more started out with the Cusco 300 and wasn't, as a small kid, wasn't, because the Cusco was in Bethel, so we got to watch that every year, but was also aware of Iditarod because the mushers that were coming out to run the Cusco were all famous Iditarod mushers like Jeff King and Martin Boozer and all these guys. So I was aware of Iditarod, and I mean, when I started getting really serious about mushing, Iditarod was definitely on the radar. And I mean, if you're into mushing and into any kind of distance mushing, how can you not dream about winning the Iditarod? I mean, it's just such a special thing. So
how does it feel to have that dream come true today?
It's amazing, but honestly, it's not going to sink in here for a while, probably. You know, it's too much to take in all at once with a brain that's running off of 5 hours sleep in the last 5 days or something. So.
Okay, so another thing. Can you talk to us about the dogs that brought you in? Who were your leaders, and what have they been like this race, and who were the rest of the dogs on your team?
Yeah, the two leaders that were up on the stage were Morrow and Lucy. Lucy is 4, and she led almost all the way last year. Morrow led into the finish with her last year. This is Morrow's third year finishing in lead. She's 7, and she's also won the Cusco in lead. So she's a pretty awesome dog. She doesn't run in lead like all the time. She kind of gets bored with it, but she seems to always be able to step up like when you really need her. So she didn't lead until we got to Caltag or Uniclete or Shektulik, I can't remember. But then she was kind of the driving force through all that wind and deep snow coming here. So I kind of had a plan to save her in the team and put her in there later if we needed her. And then there was another one, Lucy's sister Frida, that did a lot of leading too.
Anybody else?
We're going to wrap it up here pretty quick.
So. Can I ask one? What are you going to do now that you're, what's next for you at, I don't know what time it is. 4:30 a.m.
Shower and sleep, probably. Eat something.
Can I ask you a quick question about what it means to you as a dad? I mean, you had a 6-year-old, obviously, watching that as a role model, looking at that. How does that feel?
It's pretty cool. I mean, I can't imagine he won't, you know, not forget this ever, I would think, you know. So it's pretty neat to be able to share it with the wife and kids. And yeah, so it's awesome.
Congratulations,
everybody. Awesome.